Today we are back into our series on the bad habits of Jesus. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. But his way made a lot of people mad. It made some people so mad that they decided to kill him, that his habits were just that bad. Now, I'm not going to take the time to rehash where we've been. I just want to jump into today. And as we look at Jesus' bad habit of breaking all the rules, Jesus had a habit of being a rule breaker. And there's a part of me that really loves that. Being a little bit of a rule breaker is probably why I'm not at my last job. There is that rebellious side in me, and you maybe can connect with that. There's a piece of me that says if the rule is pointless, I can ignore it, and that's probably not a good thing. I don't like being told where to go or what to eat. Over the last 3 months, I've been focused on getting healthy. I stood up in a part of our Double Dog Dare series and shared some of the dares that I was taking, and part of that had to do with physical health, and I told you that I had set a goal to lose 32 pounds, and as of this week, I've lost 34, and that's pretty fantastic. I get to live longer. I saw my doctor this week. My blood pressure's down. I'm in a good place. That's wonderful, but I hate when that little phone says, that's enough calories for today, and that little app says, nope, no more, or don't eat that. I hate rules. There's a part of me that gets that rebellious side. But there's another side of me that really likes rules because I like to win. And I played basketball growing up. I've told you that. And without the boundaries, without the rules, nobody wins. And there's a part of me that really likes the rules because they let me know how I'm doing. They let me know if I'm winning. They let me know if I'm losing. They let me know if I'm good or bad, if I'm okay or I'm in trouble. There's a part of me that likes the rules. And so probably if I was alive during Jesus' time, I probably would have attempted to be one of those the Pharisees, one of the guys who had some 600 plus bunch of rules about everything related to God and not related to God, because then I would feel like I knew where I stood. But Jesus, he didn't seem to operate that way. He didn't seem to see faith that way or religion or connection to God that way at all. He was a rule breaker. He got him into all kinds of trouble with the powers of the. In fact, his refusal to follow the rules is part of the reason he ended up dead. He had bad habits, especially for a Jewish rabbi. And as we think about it, what we find is that he healed on the Sabbath, the day you weren't supposed to do anything. He ate with unwashed hands. You think, well, that's not a big deal, except their religion required them to wash their hands in two separate pots before they ate. It really was kind of interesting because if you were poor, and most people were in that time, you couldn't even afford the sets of pots needed to be able to wash your hands and be ritually clean before you ate. So that meant you were an unclean person. So Jesus ate dirty food with dirty hands, with dirty people, and he continued down this path of breaking God's rules, or what seemed to be God's rules anyway. He let his disciples swipe food from another person's field and eat it, on the Sabbath no less. He spoke about God with this kind of unholy familiarity, this comfort level that would make people blush. He refused to punish people according to the laws of Moses when he was given the option. And perhaps worst of all, he declared himself equal to God. He declared himself as God, God's Messiah. He flouted rules, violated taboos, and promoted behavior that was just nightmarishingly wrong in the eyes of the establishment and the synagogue and the people around him. He wasn't just kind of bad at keeping the Sabbath. In the eyes of the religious establishment, he sinned against God almost every week when it came to the Sabbath. The world that Jesus seemed to be trying to create and endorse and bring about was just turned upside down for everything they knew about connecting with God. They didn't know how to handle this guy, Jesus, and the things that he was doing and saying. Because he seemed to be the only one who understood that God was never out to control creation from the outside. He seemed to be the only one that understood God's desire to be a guiding light from within, to transform from within, to lead through relationship. Jesus broke everything that seemed to say you were right or wrong with God. And so those looking from the outside would have thought him some kind of heretic rabbi. His followers kicked out of their religion eventually. He not only broke religious rules, he broke social, cultural rules. In his hometown, he would have been a scandal simply for remaining single. It was a spoken and unspoken rule, especially as the oldest son in the family, that he would get married and reproduce and continue the name of his family. He owed it to his ancestors. It was a duty to his family that he seemed to shrug off. Later, rabbis took this so seriously that once they wrote, seven things are condemned in heaven. And the first of these is a man without a woman. Now, Jesus seemed to think they were wrong. So if you were a man without a woman, don't fear. You're just a little more like Jesus today. And that's okay. But Jesus didn't break rules just to be some kind of rebel. He was on a mission to just revolutionize the way we thought and connected to God, to ourselves and to each other. He seemed to live with a mantra, with a life goal to support life and love. Scripture tells us that God is life and love, not that he owns or he brings about, but God is life, that nothing exists outside of God. To speak philosophically, he is the ontological source of everything that exists. Should God be disconnected from us in any way, we would cease to exist. Every bit of life issues forth from God. Every breath issues forth from God. The heartbeat in your chest is God's presence within you. There is no life apart from God. Not only does it tell us he is life, but he is love. Not that he loves well or loves a lot. He is love. His very substance, very being is love. He is love. God is life and love. And if there were any rules that Jesus lived by, it was the rule of life and the rule of love. That everything he did, every rule he broke, was about bringing blessing, about bringing life, about bringing love, especially to those from whom it was being taken. He was on a mission. He modeled what it was to really be free, to really be free, to be able to step beyond the sets of customs and traditions that bind us, to step beyond the rules of his own self-preservation, his own ego, his own insecurities and fear, and to really be so free that he didn't need rules. You see, true freedom negates the necessity of rules. True freedom that is absolutely free is the kind of freedom that's free to choose God's will, to choose the common good. And like I said, it negates the needs for rules. Rules at their best. Rules when they are functioning the way they're meant to function, at the highest of their value, protect the common good. Rules and laws at their very best bring about what is good for everyone involved. But because we know those who make the rules and the laws are not always free in and of themselves, they have not all received that freedom, we find that in many cases the rules simply serve to protect the powerful and to serve the wealthy, and often at the expense of keeping others locked out from good. In the garden, we were free. And in the garden, there were no rules. You say, oh wait, there was one. But really, it wasn't a rule. Jesus simply said, Adam, Eve, I wouldn't eat of that tree because you'll die if you do. It's not a rule. It's a warning. It's not, it wasn't, it was just this, hey, if you see everything good I've given you, live there. And watch out, because that one's going to hurt you. There doesn't have to be rules when there's relationship. When love is at the center, when there's really freedom, but freedom is hard. Jesus, unlike most people today, lived truly free. And it was Jesus' freedom that made it possible to do whatever was needed in the moment for whomever it was needed. You see, think about that just for a second. Jesus was free enough to do whatever was needed in the moment. He was free enough to do whatever was needed in the moment. Are we free to do what is needed in the moment? Are we free to give the way that is needed? Are we free to love the way that is needed? Are we free to serve the way that is needed? Are we free to bless the way that is needed? Are we even free to give encouragement the way that is needed? Or are we bound? Are we bound by our fear? Are we bound by a fear of how we might be perceived? Are we bound by a fear of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing? Are we bound by our insecurities? Do we fail to see ourselves as God sees us, so we are bound by those insecurities and unable to step into a moment and do what is needed for those around us, to do what is best in that moment, to do what is good for those around us, to bring about something that is a blessing for others because we're insecure? Are we free of our own need of self-preservation, our own selfishness to actually do what's needed in the moment? Or are we thinking, well, if I do this, I might not have enough? And we're bound, not really free. Is it sin that gets in the way? Is it our own ego? I mean, to really be free, we must be free of our ego as well. I mean, that's what binds us most, right? This need for what I need, this need for what I want, this desire for my dreams, my ambitions, without a real thought to how it affects others. To really be free, to really be truly free, to be able to do what is needed in the moment, we've got to be consumed with the will of God. We are will matching His to the point of being able to actually do what is needed in the moment. And Jesus lived truly free. We can see an example of it in Luke chapter 13. If you have your Bibles, you can turn there. Start in the middle and work your way toward the back. Matthew, Mark, Luke. Matthew, Mark, Luke. And then we'll be in chapter 13. If you have, you can pull one of the Bibles from in front of you. If you don't own a Bible, please take that, a gift from Hydrant Church to you. If you have our Hydrant Church app, you can find the Bible right there, or the YouVersion, or Google it, or whatever you need. Luke chapter 13. And we'll begin reading at verse 10. It says this: one Sabbath day, as Jesus was teaching in a synagogue. Now, Sabbath day, remember the day we do nothing, the day we stopped. God created everything in 6 days and then rested. And He said, because I rested, I want you to rest on the seventh day. It's my gift to you. It reminds you that I'm the one who provides. I work on that day so you don't have to. I'm the one who's got you, and this is the way I show it. I've given you this gift. On the Sabbath day, focus on me and on rest. So on the Sabbath day, Jesus was teaching in a synagogue. He saw a woman who had been crippled by an evil spirit. She'd been bent double for 18 years and was unable to stand up straight. He enters into a moment and a need arises. I find it interesting that she didn't come over to him until he invited her. I find it interesting that she didn't ask for help. He recognized the need, and he says to her, he says, when Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, dear woman, you are healed of your sickness. Then he touched her, and instantly she could stand straight. And oh, how she praised God. Imagine being bent over for 18 years, unable to stand up straight, and suddenly you're able to stand up straight. Some of us need to see in our mind's eye that our soul for so many years was broken and bent over, and that he set us free to be able to stand straight and let that infuse our worship. Sorry, that's a tangent. So verse 14, the leader in charge of the synagogue is angry. In fact, it says he was indignant that Jesus healed her on the Sabbath day. Here's what he says. There are 6 days for working. If she wants to be healed, she needs to come on one of those days. And if you want to heal her, you need to do it on one of those days, not on the Sabbath. I love how Luke says this. He doesn't say Jesus replied. He says, but the Lord replied. We forget sometimes who made what rules do exist, don't we? The Lord replied, you hypocrites, each of you works on the Sabbath day. Don't you untie your animals, your ox or your donkey from his stall on the Sabbath and lead it out for water? Imagine, none of you would be so cruel as to leave an animal tied up and unable to have its nourishment, unable to have water. He said, this dear woman, a daughter of Abraham, your sister is what he's saying, has been held in bondage by Satan for 18 years. Isn't it right that she be released even on the Sabbath? This shamed his enemies, but all the people rejoiced at the wonderful things he did. Jesus lived free. He lived free of fear. You see, he could have been kicked out of the synagogue at that moment. You think, well, that's no big deal. Just go to another one. It's what we do, right? You get kicked out of one church, you cause too much trouble, you break too many rules, which honestly, that's probably why I'm not at the last church I worked at. Maybe a little bit. Anita, my wife. If you don't know that, Anita, who leads worship, is my wife. I'm blessed, encouraged. She teaches me. She taught me this morning, and what a wonderful thing. And I'm sorry for the rules I've broken that have messed us up sometimes. He lived free of fear. Kicked out of the synagogue. He could have been kicked out of the synagogue, which to us, like I said, getting kicked out of church, no big deal. We'll just go find another one. There are 400 in Goldsboro. I'm not even making that's not an exaggeration. There are 400 churches in Goldsboro. 30,000 people in 400 churches. We'll just go find another one. But he couldn't do that. See, to get kicked out of the synagogue is to be kicked out of community life. Around the synagogue is where connections were made, where family was celebrated, where business deals could be brokered. Like there was a sense of life togetherness, to be kicked out of your faith, to be excommunicated. So to be kicked out of the synagogue was a very real and powerful thing, especially for a rabbi. And he had no fear, willing to do what needed to be done in the moment without fear of the consequences, without fear of where it might lead, without fear of if I do this, then this might happen. Or if I heal her, then 100 other people are going to want to be healed too. Ever done that? Do for one what you wish you could do for them all. Let God take care of the details. He lived without fear. He lived without any sense of insecurity. They sometimes think, well, I'm not sure I can do that. What if Jesus had said, well, I'm not sure if God will heal her. No sense of insecurity. No sense of, well, I'm going to call her over, and I'm going to tell her that she's healed. And our first thought, well, what if it doesn't happen? Right? No sense of that. No sense of worry about what might or couldn't happen. It was a confidence in that relationship with God. No insecurities getting in the way of him doing what he needed to do, of teaching when the opportunity came to teach, of speaking to the one, to calling her over. He shouldn't have even been talking to her. Especially as a rabbi in the synagogue, as a man, he would not have been allowed. He broke a rule just talking to her, much less healing her on that day. But there was no sense of that. No sin that got in the way of him being free to do what he wanted. I had a professor in college who said that sin is the delusion of self-sovereignty, which is another way of saying you do whatever you want because you think you're in charge. There was no sense of I do whatever I want because I think I'm in charge getting in the way of Jesus. There was. He even said that everything he did came from the Father. Everything he said came from the Father. There was no sin, no ego getting away, no obstacles getting in the way of him doing what was needed in the moment. He was fully free to bless, to love, to bring life to this person that he had the ability and opportunity to do so. No ego, no sense of, well, what will this mean for me? Or what will happen to me if I do this? Or what about me? Or when's somebody going to encourage me or say something nice to me or do something for me? No sense of that. No sense of just pursuing what was good for him. It was what will bring about God's will in this moment. How did he live with such freedom? Because I mean, we feel like, okay, God, you can set me free. And God begins to set us free from fears and insecurities and sin. But we still have this ego mess to where we somehow continue to pursue what's good for me and think it's freedom when I get to do whatever I want. And that gets in the way. And being really free from ego, really free to provide and do what's good for all, versus what's just good for me. He was able to do that. How did he do this? I believe that he found his freedom in his trust in the Father. He found his freedom in his trust of the Father. Instead of trying to hold on to the Father, he let the Father hold on to him. Instead of trying to hold on to God, he let God hold on to him. He really trusted God. How often does our lack of trust get in the way of doing what's needed in the moment? Do we trust God enough to provide for us to give when the opportunity comes? Do we trust God enough to provide our security, our identity, our hope, our strength, to love freely? Do we feel that kind of freedom? It's often our lack of trust that locks us down and keeps us behind our unspoken rules and holding on to the rules around us. Now, here's what I mean by unspoken rules. The rules that we don't tell anybody else we have. Maybe you've said this to yourself, or maybe you've said it out loud. I'll never do that. I could never. You won't catch me. I'm too introverted to, no, I could never. God has this really cruel way of having me do everything I tell him I'm never going to do. Every place I've said, God, I'm not moving there. We lived. He's funny like that. Yet we hold on to those. We think that's somehow who we are and we feel safe in them because we don't trust him enough. In fact, we do that with our religion, don't we? If we can create the rules that tell us we're right with God, if I do this, 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 and this, how wonderful that is. We, as the church is growing, we're stepping up as a team. Our development, our growth, and the things we need to do, and meeting expectations, and some of those kind of things. And so, one of the things that actually the staff kind of asked for, and I obliged, was a set of expectations, a quarterly set of expectations, just a checklist of the things that are expected and needed. And you know, I don't naturally kind of work that way. I can operate in a more flexible environment, but it's not necessarily good for everybody. And so we did this, and there's such a security for them and for each of us sometimes in knowing exactly what's expected and checking the things off the list. And we often look at God that way. We look at God and say, well, I read, and I prayed, and I did this, and I did that, and I met all the expectations, so now I'm good. Bless me, God. Or you say, well, I don't really think that way. When something bad happens, have you ever said to God, God, but you know I did this, 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 and this. Why did this happen? Maybe we do think that way more often than we realize. There's a security we feel in the rules, a sense of safety, a sense of identity, a sense of being able to get a hold of things. We really fear freedom. And our lack of trust leads to that fear. And that fear leads to us reaching for control, making rules, and that control leads to oppression, oppressing ourselves. And really, if we're honest, if we're afraid to live free of the rules, then we're certainly afraid of someone else living free of the rules. So we better enforce the rules wherever we have influence. And so we live and we grab after and we try to hold on to these rules because we don't trust God to handle those things. We don't trust God to provide and lead and direct and show us what we need. We don't trust that God will give us grace and forgiveness and love and guidance enough. We need the rules. We need your expectations set, God. And Jesus, he just stepped out of that. You know, if it's not that, we tend to allow our lack of trust to lead us to pursue false freedoms. If we are not those who hold on to the rules out of fear and avoidance of freedom, we tend to pursue the wrong kind of freedom. The kind of freedom that says, I get to do whatever I want when I want. That's freedom. Freedom of speech, the ability to say whatever I want, whenever I want, without consequence. That's the kind of freedom we want. We want to do whatever we want, however we want. We don't want anyone to tell us what to do. I want to be able to spend what I have and do what I want whenever I want. We want to see ourselves in this false freedom of self-sufficiency, that I have got this, that I am sufficient in and of myself without anyone or anything else. And so all I really need to pursue is my own good, what's good for me. And if it's not self-sufficiency, it's often self-indulgence that we pursue. And we think that if I have the freedom to do whatever I want, to indulge any whim or desire that I have, then that's what's really free. I'll really be free when I can have enough financial freedom to do whatever I want. When I have enough freedom to go where I want, to have enough freedom. It's the freedom we long for with that 16-year-old birthday. Suddenly freedom. And it's this false freedom. Any freedom that robs someone else of their freedom is not true freedom. And that's what it often looks like. Our limitless choice comes at the expense of those weaker than us and the poor around us. Anytime we have to exploit others, if we have to neglect others or deny others to get what we think is good for us, then we need to really think about whether it's really good. Jesus was able to find real freedom, true freedom. He found true freedom in the sense of his relationship with God by refusing to play by the rules or to play the game at all. So I told you, I like basketball. You've got rules about where is in and out and which basket you can shoot at and what you can do to stop someone else from scoring. And there's a set of rules that determines the game. But if you're playing horse, the rules don't apply. If you're not playing the game, then the rules don't apply. And Jesus just decided, I'm not playing those religious games. It's not a game. Our connection to the Creator is not a game we win or lose. It's not about how many times we obeyed all the rules and did all the things that preacher said we ought to do. It's not about how many times we read our Bible this week, not how many times we got things right. Not about how many times we prayed or how much we gave. It's not about that. And Jesus seemed to step outside of that game, that set of rules that said you're in or you're out, you're good or you're bad, you're approved or you're not. He stepped outside of it and was able to do what was needed in the moment that brought life and love into the creation the way that God intended. We see it again in Mark chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, when he heals the man's withered hand again on the Sabbath. He heals the man, and then he says to them, the Sabbath was not meant to be like this. He says, man was not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath for man. What he's saying is that you were not made for the rules, but the rules were a gift. When they operate the way they're supposed to. Sabbath in particular. He says, you're not meant to live in this servitude, this slave-like response to Sabbath. Sabbath was a gift to give you rest. And that's how it's meant to be experienced. And Jesus turns these things upside down over and over again, showing the underside of what things really mean. Showing that the instruction in the garden was not a rule but a warning. Showing that the Sabbath is not a rule but a gift. And over again, he seeks to bring life and to show that faith is not a game. It's not about the rules, but about the relationships. If we go all the way back to creation, we can see that we were created for relationship. We are created first to be in a relationship with God, in a connection with Him that fuels and fills everything. And that having that connection right with God, we begin to see ourselves for who we are. And as we see ourselves for who we are, we find a good and pure and real relationship with ourselves where we're not living in denial, where we're not playing games with ourselves, we're not manipulating ourselves, we don't live with self-hatred. We find this good and healthy relationship with ourselves. And having that character and integrity of a right and pure relationship with ourselves, it fuels outward in relationship with others and eventually to do the thing we were created to do in relationship with creation. The trouble is, we'd rather have the rules than relationships. And so what happens is that relationship with God, the source, breaks. And we try to prop it up with rules and pretend like it's not broken. And then because that relationship breaks, these don't work right. And we don't have a view of ourselves that we should, and we don't see others. They're just something we can use to get what we want. We don't even see creation the way it was meant to be. And this relationship with God breaks and everything else breaks, but the rules prop it up and help us to pretend like it's all okay. So we choose the rules again and again and again because they're easier. They're easier to understand whether you're winning or losing. And yet God says, no, 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 no. It's not meant to be about the rules. You see, as kids, human children take longer to go from infancy to adulthood than any other creature in all of creation. And it's not because instincts we need to learn. It's because of the ability to connect to other people and operate in society. It takes a long time to learn that. Some of us are still learning that. Some of us never learn that. But as children, children need rules. Children need rules. Children need the boundaries that clearly keep them safe and learning how to connect with others. But there comes a time when the rules should be replaced with a relationship of love and mutual respect. To the point that we have children who trust us enough in relationship to obey our instructions without us having to give the rules. You see, as our children get older, my son turned 10 this week. I know some of you have teenagers, you have grown kids. My mom's here, she's looking, yeah, my kid's old up there with more gray than, never mind. I got a 10-year-old. He has spent more days in my home than he will likely spend in the future. But as he gets older, I should be able to give him fewer and fewer rules. As my children get older, there should be fewer and fewer rules in the house, not more, if I'm doing my job right. And that's on me, to help him grow up and learn and trust and build that relationship. It's on me, parents, it's on us, not on our kids to build a relationship with us, it's on us to build a relationship with them. And to build such a relationship of trust and mutual respect that there is a love that we know that we each want what's best for the other. And we trust and support and help one another. And are able to guide them into freedom from those rules because of the relationship. It's not easy, but it's the way it's meant to be. Now, that should happen for all of us. Even spiritually, there's this sense at the very beginning, what are the rules? How does this work? We begin to figure it out. And then we grow into this relationship with God that changes everything. You see, God's desire has never been to control us from the outside with rules, but to guide us like a light from the inside, to guide us from within. In Matthew chapter 15, you can find it. Matthew chapter 15, verse 10, 11 and 18. Jesus says this. So he called the crowd to him. He says, listen, listen, listen and understand. What goes into someone's mouth does not defile them. But what comes out of their mouth, that's what defiles them. In verse 18, but the things that come out of a person's mouth come from the heart and defile them. So who we are in the heart, who we are on the inside, is how God wants to guide us. God wants to be within us, guiding us like a light from within, showing us the way, transforming us from the inside. His desire was never behavior modification, but soul transformation. His desire was never to change what you do so much as it is to change you at the very core of who we are, so that we're able to grow up in love toward Him and in service toward Him and into the world around us with genuine, open freedom to transform us from the inside out. Not to manipulate behavior. Not to make us robots who are able to do the things that He expects and check it off the list and suddenly we're approved. And it's a struggle for us, though. In spite of God's desire, God desires this inner relationship that's transforming, not a set of rules that we obey. Yet, some of us are still very afraid to really follow this Jesus because we fear the rules. We fear the expectations. We fear that our inability to keep them or a lack of desire to keep them. And what we really need to hear, if that's us, is that Jesus demonstrates a way of being in relationship with the Creator, with God, that operates based on a relationship, not a set of rules. No one's ability to keep the rules or inability to keep the rules determines their approval in the eyes of God. God's love beckons us all, invites us all to walk with Him, to trust Him, to see that His will is really about what's good for us as individuals and what's good for us all together. So you see, to trust God and follow His will at its really just basic level is to pursue the common good. God's will be done, God's kingdom come on earth. This expectation, this prayer is about what is really and truly good for all creation. After all, after each day, He looked at all that was created and said, "Ooh, this is good." Then He got done with everything and said, "This is very good." And His desire is that all creation would return to that place of good. And He puts us here with that purpose of pursuing good. So to pursue the will of God is to pursue what is good. It's really kind of interesting. Sometimes I struggle. That rebellious side of me comes out when I read passages like, "If you love me, you'll obey me." I think, ooh, I don't like that one. But then you think and you realize, well, what is it to obey God? Well, it's to pursue His will. Well, what is His will? His will is for my very best. So, God, You really want me to pursue what's good for me and good for those around me. And if I love You, that's what I'll do. Okay, that's a very different story than "if you love me, you'll obey me." And it's not because that's not what He was saying. It's just because I misunderstand Him often. You see, God's desire is that we would join Him in being the answer to that prayer, "Your kingdom come, Your will be done," and bringing about that common good. Now, it will require of us confession and repenting, or turning around from all the ways we've pursued what's only good for me. All the ways that we have selfishly rejected His ways and chosen what only we want. Let Him to forgive us and restore us. So let Him free us from fear and insecurity, from the disappointments of our past, the bitterness, the anger, and the hurt, and most of all, our own egos. Jesus desires to have a relationship, not to force you into some mold of good rule keeping. Now, some of us, in spite of God's desire, is not that we're afraid to follow Him because of the rules, but we're afraid to trust God. So we cling on to Him with our rules in an effort to stay close. Let me give you an example that helps. I am not a cat person. I don't like cats. I don't like anything about cats. Somehow, at one time in my life, I was persuaded to own a kitten. It did not make it out of kittenhood before it was no longer in my possession. But we had it for a little while. And this kitten decided one day that it wanted to be close to me, that it wanted my attention. So it started at the back of my leg, the very bottom, and used its little tiny sharp needle-like claws to grip on and climb. All the way up the back of my leg, all the way up my back until it was sitting on my shoulder, like a parrot. Clinging all of its little needle-like claws, not into my clothing, but into my arm. Took everything I had not to grab the cat and remove it. Clinging with everything it had for a little attention. And yet, it would have been so much happier if it would have allowed me to simply hold it and to pet it and to give it a little attention. I would have been happier, but the cat would have been much happier. Might have lipped. No, I'm just kidding. It's not dead. We do that to God. We climb up and cling on with everything we got like he doesn't want to give us attention, or like that somehow we're going to just drift away. Like we got to cling on instead of letting God hold us. We try to use our rules to cling on to him. That if I can keep all these rules, I'll stay close to God. I'll be approved by God. I'll get God's attention. And we use those rules to climb up his back. Because we don't see his willingness and desire to simply hold us, allow us to find refuge in him. His desire for those of us who would use those rules to try to get his approval and attention is to see that we cannot hold our lives together with the twine of rules. They can only be held together with the relational cords of grace and love. Ezekiel chapter 36, verse 26 says that he'll take that heart of stone, that rule-keeping heart, and replace it with one of love and grace and flesh that is able to connect with him. Now, some of us, in spite of God's desire to lead from the inside, to guide us, to embrace us, to bring about our good, we allow ourselves sometimes when we've been in the church for a while, we've been following him for a while, and we've begun to understand this faking game, and we've faked it some, to become keepers of the rule book. Some of us become these referees of holy behavior and appearances, and we leave anywhere, and our first thought is about how poorly someone else is doing in their whatever. We need to hear that critical and the censorious spirit that we can gain, where we begin to view our mission in life as the yardstick and scales of others' faith, will only lead us to wooden and metallic souls. We need to realize just how much we've been forgiven. Because those who have been forgiven much love much. There have been days we have pursued our own good exclusively. Our ego has run and ruined many of our days, our conversations, our actions, and God's forgiveness is overwhelming. His new beginnings are without end, and he invites us to extend that forgiveness that we've been given. You see, we have been forgiven so much, loved so much, and when we withhold that from others, it's as if we cut the very branch that we sit upon. He says, if you won't forgive, there will be no forgiveness for you. That's probably the hardest teaching of Jesus for me. He tells them, if you won't forgive, there will be no forgiveness for you. Forgiveness is hard, but having been forgiven, we must love much. Jesus broke all the rules, not because he was some kind of religious rebel. He broke the rules to bless people, to bless you and me. Jesus contradicted the assumptions, the customs, the rules of his society and religion to bless people, to bring about their true good, that the good that their souls so desperately craved. He said to his followers that they were no longer servants who simply obeyed instructions and rules, but now they were friends who lived in relationship with Jesus. If we're going to embrace the habits of Jesus, we need to understand and believe God's desire, His will, His kingdom is about what's good for us, good for all of us. Psalm 31:19 says, "How abundant are the good things that you have stored up for those who fear you or trust you, those you bestow in the sight of all, on those who take refuge in you." The good things. Then 2 Samuel 12:8, the last part of this verse, he's talking to he's talking to the king, and he says, "I've given you this kingdom, I've given you all of this," and here's what he said. "And if that had not been enough, I would have given you much, much more." And if that had not been enough, I would have given you much, much more. And yet we live in some kind of scarcity mode with God, that we better keep the rules or everything's going to disappear. We better keep all the rules or it's all going to fall apart. And we wonder when things get a little bit hard why God has forsaken us. And yet He is the very God who says, if you trust me, if you'll let me hold you, if you'll really trust me enough to be free to do what's needed in the moment, you'll have everything that is enough and much, much more. I will give you those things. And yet we're so afraid. We cling on to them and we cling on to anything we can that gives us this security. He says, I am willing to keep pouring out good. God's desire for us is good. You see, our Christian faith is about identity and love and rest, not rules. Jesus came to set us free. He said it. And if I set you free, you will be free indeed. He came to give us rest. Matthew 11, 28, he says to them, "Come to me, all who are weary and carry heavy burdens." And the burdens he's talking about are the rules. What you hear in just a moment, he says, "I will give you rest." Verse 29, "Take my yoke upon you." He's not talking about the big wooden beam that they strap to the back of an oxen to have him pull a plow. A yoke of a rabbi was his set of teachings. So what he's saying is, if you are tired, if you are weary, if the burden of the rules of your religion have gotten so heavy that they weigh you down to the point of misery and exhaustion, come to me and I will give you rest. My yoke is light. Take it upon you. Let me teach you, because I am humble and gentle at heart, and you will find rest for your souls. My yoke is easy to bear, and the burden I give you is light. It's not rules, it's relationship. When we've been set free, the result is a freedom to bless others. Two quick stories as we wrap this up. One is from Scripture, Luke chapter 10, verse 25 through 37. We hear a story that we've all at least heard the name of, the parable of the Good Samaritan. And in this story, there's a man who's been beaten and left to die on the side of the road. And very religious men, keeping the rules, because today is the day of worship, they're traveling on the road, headed toward the temple to take care of their religious duties. If they stop to help the man, they'll be unclean and unable to handle their responsibilities. So they keep going. Follow the rules. One and then another. And then a Samaritan, an enemy, a hated one. One who thinks differently about everything, religion, worship, God, comes by and he stops and he helps the man. He bandages his wounds and he takes care of him. Not only that, he puts him up in an inn where he is, all of his needs are taken care of, and the money is provided to take care of the man as long as it takes until he is well. Sometimes we miss the weight of this story. Something's missed in translation across the years. What we need to imagine is, imagine it like this. One of you is beaten and left on the side of the road. Pastor Caleb walks by, says, "Oh, I'll be late. I'll be late for church. I better hurry. I can't stop and help." And he keeps going. Then Pastor Casey comes by and says, "Oh no, Got first contact stuff. Got to get the coffee ready. I just don't have time, and keeps going. And then a Muslim on his way to worship in the mosque comes by, thinks differently. You really want to drive it home? Imagine a Muslim terrorist. Worships, thinks, acts differently, stops, and takes care of your every need, and provides for every need until you are fully healed. That's the weight of this. That's the way that the imagery of that enemy. And Jesus says, go and do likewise. That's freedom, to love and do what is needed in the moment, regardless of the rules that broke. They're supposed to hate each other, and he helped. Not supposed to touch each other, and he helped. It didn't matter. When life and love was on the line, Jesus modeled and called us to choose life, to choose love. Last story. My friend Kerry Willis, he pastors a church up in Virginia. He has a book, you can actually find it in our store. It's called Relational Leadership. The lessons he learned from his fisherman father. He had spent his 14th and 15th and 16th year as he was headed toward his 16th birthday working on his father's shrimp boat and saving money to buy his dream car. Brand new. And he turned 16. His mom drove him to the DMV, took his test, got his license, drove home. And just before he's about to go outside and get into his brand new hot rod and drive it on his own for the first time, he calls his dad outside with him. And he calls his dad out and says, okay, Dad, give me the rules. His dad kind of looks at him. And it's kind of funny because Kerry's a good foot taller than his dad was. And he's kind of looking at his, and says the conversation got awkward. And he's like, what do you mean? He's like, come on, Dad, tell me what you expect. He's like, I don't understand. He says, Dad, I just turned 16. I'm getting ready to leave. New freedom, license, new car. What are the rules? When I come home, what am I supposed to do? Oh, just tell me what you expect. He said in this very awkward moment, his dad looks at him. He says, there are no rules. Just don't break our hearts. There are no rules. Just don't break our hearts. I think some of us need to see our faith again as our Father in heaven saying, it's not about the rules. Just don't break my heart. Just don't break my heart. As children, we need to hear and need to see the way we operate and just not break the hearts of our parents. As adults, we just don't break the hearts of your kids, your spouse, your friends, your God. That's what it's about. Love well. Let the relationship guide you. It's what he invited us to. It's what he says today. No rules. Just don't break my heart. He says, I gave it all for you. Everything I have, my very life, I laid it on the line. My body was broken and my blood was spilled out to connect you to the Father, to give you life, to give you this relationship. Just don't break my heart. In just a moment, you're going to be invited to the table to come and receive. To receive the bread and the cup, to break the bread and dip it. And to hear the words, my body broken for you and my blood spilt for you. And the table is for all of us. All of us who would say, God, I know I've broken your heart more times than I can count. And I'm so sorry. I need your grace. I need your forgiveness. Would you help me not to break your heart? Would you help me to trust you, to live free, to live the way you created me to? That's all it's about. It's about grace. We call it a sacrament. Sacrament means a holy moment, something ordinary infused with something sacred. There's nothing more ordinary than bread and the fruit of the vine. And yet there is something mysterious in which we experience and become aware of God's presence. Something about it can shake our souls awake. There's something about this meal. I'll tell you, years and years ago, I was a part of a church that received every week, and we don't do it every week. We do during Lent, but there was something about this meal that nourished a broken heart in me during that time. Something in it that brought healing and a mysterious sense of God's continual presence no matter what I faced. And so in this moment, as we prepare to receive, feel the embrace of Jesus. Feel Him saying, and wrapping His arms around you and saying, come to me, all who are weary. Let me give you rest. It's not about the rules. Just don't break my heart. And I'll be here to help you every step of the way. I'm going to pray, and then you're invited to come. To kind of come out to the center aisle, come up, break off a piece of bread, dip it in the cup, eat it, and then use the outside aisle to go back to your seats. And we'll dismiss in a moment. Let me pray for us. Father, you know it would be a lot easier if you had just given us a checklist of rules, things we could do and know, okay, that's how we get the approval. I don't know how real it would have been. And I confess my tendency to see things wrong. And I need you. I need your grace. I need your grace for all the ways that I've pursued what's only good for me. All the ways I ignored what it is you created me for. All the ways that I miss what it is you're really giving me to do in the moment because I'm not really free. And I ask that you would come in this place and you would set us free. Set us free from the sin that so easily entangles us. Set us free, God, from fear so that we really can be wholly unafraid, willing to step beyond the shores to do whatever you ask of us in the moment. Would you set us free from the insecurities and the doubts? Set us free from the self-preservation and the ego. Wash over us again with grace, with forgiveness, with a new infusion of your spirit and strength that enables us to live this life free, to live loving, not just strangers, but even enemies, to live, God, able to love well, to serve well, to give well. And God, would you help us not to break the hearts of those we love? Especially you. I pray that in this holy moment, as we receive this bread and cup, we would be reminded of all you've given to give us that life, to give us that freedom. And as we are forgiven much, send us out to love much. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. You come as you're ready.